Today is Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. This is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Donald spells his last name D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you today?
Reasonably well for my age.
Good. Glad to hear it. Donald, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Thank you. We had talked some time back about your visiting with people really interested in Grand Canyon, the generation before you. And one of those people was Merle Klubb. I think that's last name spelled C-L-U-B-B. Is that right?
Yes.
And
I'm not quite certain about the first name.
Merle, yeah. Whether it's two L's or two R's, I'm a bit...
Or a second E or an I.
Okay, yeah.
I was trying to look that up earlier, but didn't get far enough.
How did you know to go visit with Klubb? How did he get on your radar screen? Do you remember?
That's a good question, too. I heard of him or would have from Harvey Bushert.
Okay.
But Harvey probably wouldn't have known that Klubb had information I was seeking. Namely, I'd been trying to find out where the two caves, Abyss River Cave and Silent River Cave, that I knew had been found by Western Speleological Institute in the canyon were, and they weren't going to tell me anything about them.
Okay.
Except that somehow, I think maybe in their publications, they credited Merle Klubb with having been the one who told them about those caves. I think that's how it went in Cave Notes or Cave Studies, their journal that was mentioned. With everything I say, when I give a year, I consider that to be provisional.
Yes.
In lieu of checking the actual document, but I think it was in 1965 that I had a reason to be going back east, and I knew that the Klubb lived in Lawrence, Kansas. So I just was driving through Lawrence, Kansas, and decided to drop in on him, and I did, and he had a nice old house there with furnishings in there. He had an elaborate table lamp that I remember being shaped like an octagon castle tower with
colored
panels, and obviously a person with some means, and he was quite hospitable to the young upstart caver who had called on him without notice. And
oh, my.
He took me back into his kitchen where he had the Mathis Evans Grand Canyon maps on his wall.
Oh, wow.
And he pointed to the locations of the two caves exactly there, and I duly noted where they were, so I could duplicate the location on my maps, and that was how I met him. That was the only time I can recall meeting him, but he was a gentleman in the old-fashioned sense. And I'm not sure what he actually did for a living, but
he was a professor of, I want to say 14th, 15th century European literature.
Oh, well, no wonder his castle-like table lamp, then, that would have fit with that occupation. That's an interesting thing I hadn't known about him.
Okay. Did he have any Grand Canyon paintings on the walls at all? Do you remember?
I don't recall seeing those.
Okay.
Which is not to say he didn't, but those are the only two rooms I remember seeing in his house.
Okay. And he would have been in his, this would have been 65. He might have been in his 60s or 70s. Do you think?
Yes, if not older, I don't really know.
Okay. And did he recount to you any of his exploits in Grand Canyon? Did he say how he had found Abyss and the Silent River?
I know. I don't think I stayed long enough, actually, to hear stories told.
Oh, okay. Okay. Huh.
I'd already known from Harvey, I think, about the tragic flash flood death of his son.
Okay. Of his son and grandson, both of them drowned in that terrible event. And so he might not have been so interested to tell you, but I do find it fascinating that he still had the maps up on the kitchen wall.
Indeed he did.
Okay. And did he have his lines on the map, little lines of where he had hiked?
I don't remember it being marked the way Harvey did his.
Okay.
But I wasn't paying close attention to that aspect either, so
Okay.
I can't deny that he could have.
Okay. All right. But he was hospitable enough to let you in, hear you out, show you on the map, and then send you on your way.
He was.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yes, he reminded me in a way of my taxonomy professor at Colorado A&M College, Harold Harrington, who was also an old school gentleman, academic gentleman, and a pleasant conversationalist and such.
Nice. Okay. You had letter conversation back and forth with Harvey, and I think you talked about hiking with Harvey. Mm-hmm. Did you ever visit with Pat Riley?
Good question. If I did, I don't remember it in the way I do with Marston. I think probably it was all correspondence with Riley.
Okay. And then you mentioned Otis Marston, who had a nickname Doc, D-O-C-K,
yes.
As in the dock where you would tie your boat to protect your boat from the wilds of the weather and wind and things,
yes.
Get on and off the boat. Did you have a chance to meet with Marston?
I did. That was when I was in California. It would have been around the early to mid-60s, so
okay.
Probably around 1965 or 66 or thereabouts. But we'd been corresponding a bit. Presumably I had been encouraged by Harvey to contact him, and he invited me, I forget how it was that I was in his vicinity, really, but he belonged to the Bohemian Club and invited me to visit him there, which I did.
And what do you remember of that meeting?
Really nothing specific, just that we had a cordial conversation on our interest in the canyon, maybe some talk about specific areas there and so on.
Okay. Marston was kind of a short fellow, shorter.
I believe so.
Yeah.
A bit stocky, as I remember.
And he would have been in his late 60s, early 70s in the 1960s.
That's about how old he looks, I think.
Okay.
As I saw him.
All right. And the Bohemian Club, sort of a, I don't know, four-story brick building there in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco. Downstairs, there's a dining room and a bar. And Do you remember kind of where you visited and what anything else about it?
Not really. Your description would not clash with anything I remember about it.
Okay.
I just really remember that it was the sort of upper-class place that I normally wouldn't be visiting as a person of the lower middle class in a rural area.
Okay. Did he offer you a drink?
I don't know. If he did, I would have refused because I've never drunk alcohol, which is a story in itself. In Eugene, Oregon, when I started school, our kindergarten teacher earnestly invoked us never to drink alcoholic liquors or coffee or tea.
Oh.
And I took that instruction to heart and never disobeyed her in the rest of my life. And
how about that?
In retrospect, of course, I'm pretty sure she was a Mormon.
Okay.
And was giving us the Mormon doctrine in kindergarten. But I never regretted avoiding any of those things. To this day, I've never tasted coffee.
Okay.
I have tasted alcohol, didn't like it. It seemed like a bitter, biting, nasty stuff to drink anyway.
Right.
But I've seen what it does to people.
Yes, yes.
It wasn't pleasant, and I wish I could get all young people to behave as I did in regard to that.
And what do you remember visiting with Marston about?
I don't recall a single bit of the specifics. It's undoubtedly in our correspondence.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm definitely going to check that out. And you'd mentioned he had loaned you his camera.
Oh, yeah. That was the one thing that I certainly remember. He had wanted to know exactly where Robert Brewster Stanton had actually gotten to when he claimed to have climbed, I believe it was Osiris Temple. And I volunteered to try to follow the description and match his photos with modern pictures, but I had no camera. I wasn't a photographer or especially interested in being one, but if he would loan me the camera, I would investigate that for him, and I did not too long after that. And I concluded myself that Stanton had overstated the distance that they had climbed. I think he said he'd actually climbed the Tower of Ra.
Right.
Which is really not a trivial thing. And I did find where the one picture pointing east across Crystal Creek Canyon had been made. And it was interesting that Stanton's photo covered three times the width. It took me three snaps of Marston's camera to cover the same area. But I was satisfied that I was within 50 feet either way.
Wow.
Being at the right thing and lining things up in the distance.
Did Doc give you a photograph to rematch that, a copy of the Stanton photo?
Yes.
Okay.
That might be in my correspondence, so it's probably in the Marston part of it.
Right. And then it's interesting because Marston, in his manuscript of his book that wasn't published during his lifetime, definitively states that Stanton did not make it to the top of the Tower of Ra. He was just on the top of the Red Wall.
That is what I concluded.
And so Marston agreed with you. I mean, he looked at your evidence and clearly agreed.
Yes, I presume so. I haven't seen his book.
Okay.
interested in the title of that.
Okay, we'll talk about that at the end of the discussion here.
Or that could be emailed.
I'll send you one.
Very good.
Yeah. Anything else you remember about Marston? I mean, did he seem, did he belittle anybody? Did he belittle you? Was he shouting? Was he rowdy? Was he, how would you come away? What was your assessment of him?
Well, he certainly didn't belittle me. He was perfectly cordial throughout, and if he had intended to belittle me, I suspect he wouldn't have invited me to his exclusive club.
Right.
Unless he wanted to shame me before the members, which he didn't do, nothing like that. He didn't introduce me to any of the other members, for that matter.
Do you remember if he had a sense of humor?
He had a interesting, how should I put it, linguistic pattern in his correspondence. I don't recall speech being especially noticeable in any way, but he had a distinctive way of writing that I think if I were to go back into the ones of his letters I've kept, that I would recognize his letter voice, as it were.
Okay. Yeah, I always bring this up because some people say he was that way. But then when I ask people who actually visited with him, they don't concur. And they mention that he was perfectly cordial. He did have a sense of humor, seemed like a nice guy, and that was that. So I always kind of set that stage up to see what people say.
Yeah, he didn't gossip about anyone else to me. And tell me to avoid any such people, whatever.
Okay. Did he talk to you about caves at all?
I don't recall he did.
Okay. All right. So then moving on, I want to go back to Abyss and Silent River. Did you eventually go to those caves?
I did.
Knowing that this is a recording that will be archived somewhere, you're willing to talk some about those caves, I'd be interested to follow you through that. If you're not, I totally understand.
Well, I guess at this point, Silent River and the Abyss River are known in the caving community, and most of the actual dedicated cavers I know have been to them. I don't know that there's great danger of the general public descending en masse on them, considering that they're half a mile deep in the canyon in decidedly off-trail locations.
Fairly difficult to get to, yes, they are.
Especially Abyss River is a much longer height to reach. Silent River is actually a steep, short hike down from the east rim section of the north rim. And it opens on a cliff. One can get over along a ledge, and then immediately inside there's a rope drop you have to do, a 50-foot drop down into a larger part of the passage. And then if you want to go toward the main part of the cave, which heads diagonally northwest into the rim, I believe there's at least one other rope drop there before getting into a horizontal passage. Speleogenetically, it's an interesting cave in that the southwesterly trend that's the first that you reach in getting into the cave is a phreatic room, a large room that was apparently formed when completely flooded with water below the water table. But it doesn't go too far in that direction before pinching out. And in the other direction, down that slot, is apparently a younger stream passage canyon, which was at one point flowing water out into the main Nanqueep drainage. And it's not easy to traverse. It's narrow and winding, and even though on the map it looks perfectly horizontal and as if it ought to be an easy walkway, it's actually strenuous and squeezy in places, and the route goes up and down enough that you can get tired, and then if you do persist in 2,000 feet or so of that, you come to a junction. One side to the left leads to a high dome that probably tops out clear at the base of the Supai formation. It probably was once fed by a drainage from the Kaibab Plateau snowmelt.
Okay.
And then the other way to the right, at right angles, there's another phreatic tube segment, not as large as that room near the entrance, but similar in age, I think, in general origin, heading for 1,000 feet or so to the northeast. Yes, that's it. And then it goes up over a sand cliff and back down the other side of that, and you come into another intersection, and there's another passage then of northwest trending canyon, actually goes both ways, northwest and southeast. And the northwest is the more interesting in general because it heads further into the rim, and that's that's where the limestone is thick and well preserved, and where there's room for many more miles of cave. But after a few hundred feet in that direction, it gets difficult. And also, there's a small stream, active stream there, which is running into the rim instead of out of it, as one
might expect.
So that goes down a pit. And at that point, things get confusing to me because I've made three or more trips, I think, into the cave. And in those early days, we were spending 21, 22 hours doing those trips. And you can imagine that it's not an effortless procedure. And so we didn't really finish all the possible leads back there, but the easy part, we did come to those pits, and it didn't seem easy to continue, although that other passage that heads southeasterly, I went alone into that for 300 or so feet, and it kept going in that direction, but I hadn't time to go all the way that I could, so I left a coin on the wall there on a ledge, a coin of the year, which I think might have actually been a nickel, but maybe the just a penny, like I'd done at Falls Cave. And so I came back, and for decades I never heard of anyone else exploring that lead. But I heard only recently from Belinsky that they had gone farther in that lead, and that it apparently continued, although it would be heading toward the cliff at that point.
Oh.
And actually outside, at one point I somehow got clear down below the red wall and looked around, and one of the side tributaries off that area had a small spring or seep coming out at the base of the red wall, which could quite possibly be the stream from inside Silent River Cave. So it could be that still, I'd wondered, because if the cave did keep going northwesterly, it would go right through the neck of the Walhalla Plateau and might come to a connection with the cave system that feeds Bright Angel Creek in that area. Which I had gone and investigated early in my canyon activities. And it was this beautiful spring that came out of Bedding Plain in the Muav Limestone, and had little waterfalls over ledges there and so on. But the opening, it actually had an explorable-sized opening with strong wind blowing out of it above the water at this one place along the Bedding Plain. And at that time, it looked formidably nasty to go into, and I didn't try to do it. But many years later, one of my very last trips into the Inner Canyon was in the attempt to actually push that spring, and we did succeed in doing that. The crawl in was really quite scary. You had to wallow after 10 feet in this 2 to 3 inch deep, fast flowing water, and it had to be dressed accordingly not to be frozen to death. And it was just possible to crawl on your belly with the ceiling jamming down on you at the inner part. And so you didn't want to get stuck in there and have this water that might eventually run up over your nose and mouth if you couldn't hold your head up. And it reminded me of a place in a Wyoming cave, Great Expectations, that they called the Grim Crawl of Death, that led to one of their entrances. And in both cases, the rock is snaggy and will hook you. And I had to really exert a strong will to finish that crawl. There was 90 feet of that.
Wow.
But at that point, it did pop into a 5-foot-high Muav gallery, and we surveyed more than 1,000 feet of semi-maze sort of passage there, but unfortunately the water came from under a breakdown mass, and so there wasn't some big wide open gallery like at Roaring Springs, unfortunately.
And in Silent River, did you go with anybody else in there?
Oh, yes. We had a team of four or so of us.
Do you remember who else you went with?
Evan Anderson and I forget the names of the other two at the moment.
Okay.
That's all on record, too. I prepared a thorough report for the Park Service. Indeed, that was a condition for the permit to do the survey.
Nice.
So there's a good record of that. It turned out that a couple of other Arizona cavers had actually beat us into there a year or two before, but they didn't do any mapping.
Okay.
And Abyss River is a different sort of thing. It's in the Shinumo Amphitheater, I think, in Modred Abyss, and to reach it, if one's coming off the north rim, you have to do a several mile hike down from the rim and back up the abyss.
Right.
And then it comes out a respectable opening at the one side of the drainage there, and then it goes back easterly, which is a rather unusual direction in many canyon caves, and comes to a massive breakdown that includes Supai sandstone chunks in it.
Oh, wow.
So it appeared to me that cave actually was pirating a surface stream from beyond there somewhere.
Oh.
And indeed, when I was there originally, I just went on up the dry drainage for a few hundred yards, and there was a turn to the left, and sure enough, the water reappeared in the stream at about the place where I'd expect it to be coming down into the cave below. But you wouldn't know that from the surface. It's been filled with all this sandstone rubble, so on. So, interesting cave, but not one of the longer ones in the canyon.
Okay. Yeah, because I've heard that one of those caves in that Shinumu area is fairly extensive and goes quite a ways.
Well, but certainly in modern times, starting I think in the 90s, Jason Belensky, whom I think I mentioned in an earlier interview, was exploring that same area, but more thoroughly than I did, and in a more remote section of Red Wall Rim, and he began to find a whole complex of caves in that area, not that far from Elaine Castle. And they are bigger by order of magnitude or more in both length and volume than the average caves that had ever been found elsewhere in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And he's ended up over more than a decade now surveying with teams of suitably strong cavers all of these galleries that they form a maze pattern if the caves are big enough, if they haven't been reduced by canyon erosion to truncated remnants, which some of them have. But the larger ones have galleries 80 or 100 feet high and almost as wide. Leandra's cave has the biggest galleries, and I think he mapped over 8 miles in there.
Okay.
Although it's not likely to go that much further because it's in an outlying mesa where the canyons have truncated much of the cave system, which predates the present size and character of the Grand Canyon.
And that 80 to 100 foot high, 80 to 100 foot wide, those passageways, there's water in the bottom of them, is that right?
No.
Well,
not in there, at least not that I remember anyone telling me.
Okay.
They are formed completely flooded with water. The morphology indicates that. And there's some evidence, it seems, that rising water had a role in that. A part of that evidence is extensive deposits of iron minerals, limonite, hematite, that sort of thing, which may precipitate when iron-rich groundwater rises into the zone of oxygenation, and then it comes out of solution, goes from the reduced to the oxidized state and precipitates red material.
Okay.
And there is a cave dating professor, Victor Polyak, in the University of New Mexico, who has been given samples from some mammal area incrustation from the period when there was still water at the canyon floor level, at least there. And he got, I think, a uranium series date of about 3.3 million years old when that last had active water growing the mammal areas.
Okay.
So, now that actually is a very significant datum in regard to the origin of the Grand Canyon, as I'm sure you're aware that of all the geologic features of the planet, there's probably more controversy about how did the Grand Canyon form.
Oh, yes.
Than just about anything else in all of geology.
Right.
And this is a very worthy bit of evidence that there was still water table 3 million plus years ago, what's now halfway down toward the river, at least 2,000 feet below. So the downcutting has been going on since that time, and he's dated other materials from down canyon, and he's gotten dates as old as, I think, 17 million in the Hualapai region. So cave development was going on there earlier than it was in the more easterly part of the canyon. His longest cave up there now, Double Bopper by name. I knew how that was, where that name came from, but I've forgotten. But they have 44 miles of passage, which is not only more than 10 times the length of anything we surveyed in my caving in the canyon.
Okay.
But it's neck and neck with another western cave that's being actively enlarged, namely Fort Stanton Cave in Mexico, where the Snowy River breakthrough is being mapped, and also is more than 44 miles right now. But those two caves could hardly be more different, except by being both limestone solution caves, whereas the Grand Canyon systems, or those anyway, not the ones down in the Moolah, are ancient phreatic rising water caves. Fort Stanton Cave is more like Mammoth Cave, Kentucky, and being a shallow water cave formed by simple stream capture from drainages that have corrosive water feeding into the limestone. And so it's extremely flat, and we've written a book about that, in fact. The title is 12 Miles from Daylight, because the actual exploration distance by the route that the cavers have to follow, the winding of all the passages, is more than 12 miles along the route, and there's no known alternative entrance in that distance. But I've diverged from the Grand Canyon a lot there.
Well, so you mentioned that both Double Whopper and Fort Stanton have this long mileage, but they're different. What comprises Double Whopper then?
It has this maze-like pattern that follows the fracture systems in the Redwall Limestone.
Okay.
And does not have an active stream, and in fact never apparently had any large shallow stream come into it. Instead, it seems to have been that the water was making its way through the insoluble formations, the Kaibab and Toro formations are karstic on the rim and have been presumably ever since the sedimentary rocks, the sandstone and shale, have been stripped off the Kaibab Plateau. So that landscape, as you probably realize, is full of sinkholes.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably was already like that 3.5 million years ago. And the water was managing to make its way down faults to get through the insoluble sandstone and shale and siltstone
above, right.
And then got into the Redwall, where it was encountering groundwater from below and causing a particularly corrosive chemistry that allowed these huge mazes to form, with large amounts of rock being removed slowly, but steadily and down to whatever had been the outlet at that time, which I think is not well understood yet.
How do these two caves, Double Whopper and Fort Stanton, compare to other caves in the Southwest?
They are gigantic compared with most of them.
Okay.
There's not another state in the West that has caves anywhere near that length, unless you go all the way to Hawaii, where they have at least one line or one lavitude system that I think is more than 20 miles in surveyed length. But it has multiple entrances and not inaccessible. It's near the surface all the way. Whereas these canyon caves can and do go back toward and in some cases below the rim level.
40 miles is a phenomenal distance. I mean, you go that far, you kind of fall off the other side of the Kaibab Plateau.
You would if it was a straight line, but that's where the maze part
comes. Okay.
In. It's all packed into something that in the footprint is only probably a mile and a half at the most. There's something I'd need to recheck on the map.
Oh my, so there's 40 miles of passages,
yes.
but laid out on a map, it wouldn't be more than a mile and a half or 2 miles across.
Yes, whereas with Fort Stanton, it is extensive on the plot, and from the northernmost, from the exit point into the Rio Bonito there, all the way to the presently farthest end of the cave, is literally more than 8 miles in a straight line, and 12 miles is by the route they have to follow. But 8 miles actually is longer in the linear extent than Mammoth Cave, if you can believe that.
Wow.
And Mammoth Cave is the longest cave in the world, which is also a maze cave, but not of the same kind as the buffer system. But when any parameter about a cave system begins to rival or exceed Mammoth Caves, that is a big deal.
Yeah, that's...
The Grand Canyon, I for a long time thought that it was one of the least exhausted, so to speak, karst areas in terms of cave discovery, that it has to be a lot more than I was finding, anyway. And the Chinamo system has proved that it's correct. It doesn't have a large area of the canyon underlain by cave on that scale, but where it did, it really made up for it.
Yeah. Interesting.
You can walk along the canyon or along the river for miles and not see a single entrance, and then other areas there will be a concentration of them, usually along things like a monocline that's been dissected, structures that have caused widening of fracture systems and so forth. So the cave systems in the Grand Canyon are not uniformly distributed at all. They are very localized. And they were more widely distributed early on. The Red Wall had just been exposed, and from the paleo caves were growing in it. And that was a flatter landscape, so that's why there are more paleo caves breached by the canyon than there are new caves. There are just more of them formed across a wider extent.
It's funny because it seems like Grand Canyon National Park has more caves than Carlsbad National Park.
Does it actually have now? I'm not sure.
Well, I wonder.
Well, in terms of what it actually has, but not in terms of what's on record, I'm pretty sure it doesn't. you could be right, because people have been all over Carlsbad Caverns National Park, and there are dozens or even low hundreds of caves in that area, but it's been so much more locked than the forbidding gorges of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And the central part of the Grand Canyon, from Kanab Creek west toward Diamond Creek, for me, nearly terra incognita. I didn't get to do much in that area at all, except for something off on the Esplanade and below across from Diamond Creek.
Okay.
That was very late in my activities there also.
Okay. You mentioned that you had taken a river trip in 1981.
Yes.
Through the Grand Canyon. Can you tell me what you remember about that trip? How did you get on that trip?
Well, that was a non-caving river trip that was organized by people around Glenwood Springs, Colorado.
Oh.
At the time when I was living there at Ruleson. And I got to know one of the leaders of that potential trip and volunteered that I'd be interested in going, and he wanted someone who actually had some knowledge of the canyon geology, history, etc.
Oh, cool.
So I got on that team. It was a private trip with its own permit, and about a dozen of us all together, including one kayak scout and then the others were on rafts.
Do you remember some of the names of some of the people on that trip?
Oh, boy. They aren't popping into my mouth right now. But I doubt that any of them are people that you would know that have a long-term Grand Canyon interest.
Yeah, it'd just be interesting to track them down to see if they have any photos of their trip and try to archive those.
I'm sure some of them must have done that.
Okay.
But for me, it was rather different in that I had discovered, well, I'd been on a few minor river trips, as in Big Bend National Park.
Right.
But the Grand Canyon was on a scale I hadn't done before. It was a 21-day trip going all the way to Pierce Ferry.
Oh.
And I was eager to go myself, mainly so I could get a look at the Red Wall Limestone faces that face into the river, and mark down on my topo maps any interesting-looking holes I could see. Whereas the other people were in it for the river running thing, and I found that our attitudes were not exactly alike.
Right.
They actually enjoyed getting splashed. They enjoyed running the most dangerous and splashy rapid chutes they thought they could handle. Whereas to me, getting splashed was an annoyance and irritant, and I would have been happier, actually, if we'd have been able to do the, how many hundred miles is it? Well, on perfectly flat water, just drifting along at walking speed, relaxing and looking for cave mouths. And to make a trip of that kind work, I found, requires a kind of quasi-military level of organization. Who handles the shitter and all that, and
right.
The food and whatnot. And there was so much work involved in both setting up and breaking down camps in particular that I found that I only would get to do two or three hikes off from the river. And that was disappointing. Also, I learned that if you really wanted to find new caves, you'd likely be better off, for the most part, doing it from the rims than from the river.
very difficult to be able to see, to get a good vision of what's going on. You know, some parts of the river do give you that, but oftentimes not.
Yeah, so you can be down in the narrow gorge slots. And I think I've told you already about the bad experience I had in Mariscal Canyon in Big Bend where
yes.
I nearly got drowned.
Right.
I did find that I was afraid of white water. And most of the time I was tense going through the rapids, and it was also because of the rapids, it was rougher activity than I was accustomed to in hiking, but I got a pretty nasty blow on the mouth when I dropped in a rapid, and they knocked my head into one of the members on the boat, and it seemed like people took those minor injuries for granted more than I did in surface hiking. Not that I am totally a stranger to other things. I've also rafted the Green River north of Green River, Utah, and the section of Colorado from Grand Junction down toward Rabbit Valley and such.
Okay.
And those were fine with me. But actually, the rapid that scared me the most in the Grand Canyon was Bedrock Rapid because it had all these big boulders sticking out that looked like they were quite dangerous to strike and not all that easy to avoid.
Right.
And we hit on at a point where I thought we were about to get dumped, and I almost jumped onto the rock we'd hit. And luckily, the lead boatman warned me, don't do that. I remember, though, that Lava Falls Rapid, which has the worst reputation, if I remember correctly, I didn't find that one especially scary because although the water was sort of high, there were no exposed rocks, and we just shot on through.
Yeah.
Special challenge. And the one thing I did remember liking for some reason was Sockdolager Rapid.
Oh, cool.
Gorge more for its name than anything, I think. Such a late 19th century expression.
Yeah, yes.
But I did mark down a lot of openings in the red wall where it could be seen. One of those turned out to be Stephen's Cave, which we'll talk about later, and there's more to it than the one cave. That was so near the end of my time doing things there that I ended up never really getting to any of those. I did attempt it in 1984 in the one trip I made on the Havasupai Reservation, which was illegal, I think. We were trying to reach one of those leads, but by the time we got out there, we were intimidated and decided not to do the rope drop.
Oh, okay.
Although there are other interesting features in that region.
It seems, I'm trying to remember, between Forster and Specter, so that's going to be roughly 122 mile down to, 130 in that area. You do get some views of the red wall, massive red wall up above, and some fairly interesting caves that would be pendulum caves to get into. But just reaching them, especially the ones on the north rim, well, even the ones on the south rim, would require quite a lot of logistics just to get there.
Yes, well, that's essentially why I did never get there to any degree. You know, so remote. And in fact, that one trip that I made later on, across from Diamond Creek. I was literally, as I recall it, 100-foot drive on an ugly dirt road from St. George, Utah, and all the way out to there. And that was the farthest I've ever been from a paved road in the United States, I think.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Other than Alaska.
No, it's definitely out in the middle of nowhere. It's just a hard, remote area to get to.
Yes, and unfortunately it also stormed while we were down in there, which made the road muddy. And luckily we'd had more than one vehicle, but the one that got stuck hopelessly, and we had to abandon it, and
wow.
The owner came back 2 weeks later to retrieve it.
Huh.
I was sort of annoyed by what I found down on the Esplanade there at that one point. I found a deflated rubber balloon stuck in a bush. And
yeah, they're everywhere.
Yeah, it made me realize this is aerial littering.
And yes.
I hadn't thought about it much up until then, but now every time I see televised one of these balloon releases, I cringe.
Yes.
Where are those going to end up?
Where are they going? Out into the wilds of the world to litter the countryside.
For that matter, the seaside and beyond.
Yeah, yeah, possibly so. On that river trip, did you have any boats turn over, any adventures that way, or was it pretty much?
We didn't have any flip, and I don't recall any people being tossed out of any. But down low in the canyon, somewhere near Separation Canyon, we did slide along a rock at a particular rapid, whose name I'm uncertain of, that sliced into one of the rafts. We were able to get it on down to the next intended campsite, but it had to be field repaired to continue.
Huh, I wonder which one that was. That rock down there is very sharp, so you don't want to run a boat along the side of it, because it's pretty easy to put a hole in.
Yes, we did that, and it was, as you say, but actually, when you get the material I just emailed to you, that includes an account of that trip.
Oh, okay.
And it should have the name of that canyon in it.
Cool. All right. Well, we've been visiting for almost an hour here. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series. What do you think?
It's basically up to you to structure all that.
Yeah, because I'm thinking the next things I want to ask you about are going to take a little more in-depth journey.
What might those be?
Well, We'll discuss that here after we close this interview out. In what we've talked about here, Abyss, Silent River, 1981 River Trip, Merle Club, Otis Marston, is there anything else in what we've covered that you would like to mention?
Can't think of it.
Okay. Well, with that, let's conclude part 7. Of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Today is Tuesday, January 31st, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Donald, thank you so very much.
Yes, well, thanks to you for allowing me to.
Oh, it's my pleasure.